Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Just before we jump into the episode this week, I wanted to share a little bit about the Thrive community that I run. It's a place where many like-minded women go to connect and share their experience with getting and staying successfully sober. There are different sections, like the main Thrive community feed, where people post about things that are up and coming or about challenges they're facing, and they get incredible support from other members of the group. It really is a special, special place to be right now. There are also sections to share your milestones, because every win, even the really small ones, are a big thing to celebrate, and we acknowledge that. There are five events. There are the weekly Zoom recordings, so you can go back and see all the weekly Zoom meetings and all the topics that have been covered in those meetings at your own leisure. There's a share sober tips section. And then there are group chats for the first 30 days, the first 100 days, the first year, and over a year. There's a knowledge hub as well. And in the knowledge hub, you'll find a place for books and book recommendations. There's a section of how to survive the first 30 days. So if you come in completely brand new to getting sober, you can hit the ground running and find tools and information to get a structure set up for yourself from the outset. There's also my Thrive Sober program. There's a toolkit. There's understanding the brain science and a space to read and learn about all the topics under emotional sobriety, most of which have been written by myself. So come into Thrive. If you're thinking about it or you're lacking community, I would say just jump in and go for it. And maybe we'll see you in there soon. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm talking to Lou in Shoreham-by-Sea, which is in West Sussex. And she's just turned 100 days sober. So I'm really excited to talk to you today, Lou. Obviously, you're part of Thrive as well, so we know each other. But I just think that when people get to 100 days, when you're earlier on in that journey, 100 days feels like such a big goal, but it's still very achievable. It's a weird one. It's a long time, but it's also, you know, for a lot of people, that's where they start, hitting 100 days, you know, trying to get to that milestone. So I'm delighted that we can bring this story to life and help other people that are just starting out or maybe try it again after many attempts, you know. So thank you for being here with me today.
My pleasure. I'm so excited.
Oh, lovely. So why don't you introduce yourself so that we can get to know you a little bit?
Okay, so I'm Lou. I am 49 years young. I live in Shoreham in West Sussex. I am married to my amazing husband, James. I have three children, Lauren, who is nearly 26, Jack, who is nearly 22, and George, who is 15. And then I share three amazing stepchildren with James. We've got Matt, who's nearly 26, Rebecca, who's nearly 22, and Alex, who he is 16. And we have I have a step-granddaughter, Hallie. And expecting another granddaughter in June by my daughter.
Oh my God.
So exciting.
Expanding. The family expanding.
Yeah.
That's a busy Christmas.
The joy of second marriages. Yeah. When I met him, he's like, I have three children and a granddaughter. I'm like, wow, this is going to be busy.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing. Oh, never a dull moment though, hey?
No. No.
And so what about work and what things do you do for fun? And yeah, what does all that
mean? Yeah. So in my previous life, I used to work as a children and young person specialist. And I dealt with children and young people who'd suffered from trauma through domestic abuse or going into the care system, and also children that had been adopted by special guardians, so friends and family of their parents. Sadly, I had to give that up. My 15-year-old, who is gorgeous, he suffers from, we think, anxiety, has struggled to get into school for all of his school life. And it just got to a point where my focus needed to be on him at home. So I could never guarantee that I'd be in work at 9:15 because it was like, you know, getting the boy up. So I gave that up. And also not putting it all on him. A lot of it, I suffered with my mental health a lot. And a lot of the stuff I was dealing with, I found to be quite triggering, as it sort of resonated with my past a lot. Right. So now I own my own cleaning business called Domestic Bliss. Not an advert because I'm fully booked, I'm afraid.
And you're too far away for me.
I'm too far away, yeah. Which I absolutely love. I work sort of 5 to 6 hours a day cleaning various domestic properties with my amazing clients. Weirdly, you know, people, when I was like, oh, I'm just a cleaner, but now I'm like, no, I'm not just anything. I'm awesome. And this is what I've chosen to do. And it's given me the freedom to be a lot more present at home and support George, who's now not in school. He's home educated. So, yeah. What do I do for fun? I've got two spaniels. We love taking them out. I love it more now I'm sober, strangely, because I'm not laying in my pit all weekend.
Yeah.
I love meeting up with friends still. It was really tricky in the beginning. You know, the beginning of this journey. My besties obviously have been amazing. But it's still really hard when you're first sober. You sort of want to hunker down and hide away a little bit, which is valuable. It's such a valuable thing to do. I love doing that. Crocheting. James and I are addicted to Netflix.
Yeah.
You know. And do you know what? My favourite thing since becoming sober is sitting on the sofa with a big bag of chocolate.
You've got to treat yourself.
You have got to. My sugar intake is laughable.
Yeah.
But
you're enjoying it. You're enjoying it.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. I'm so sad Easter has gone because I love those Easter eggs.
Me too. What is it about Easter shaped egg?
Ridiculous. But I mean, I bought so many. Right. Well, I'm going to put these away for the kids. You know, these are going away for the big kids and this is for the little, you know. No. And it came to Good Friday and I was like, I've got to go and get Easter eggs for the kids because I don't have any now. They'd sold out. So they all got a box of celebrations.
Oh, that is too funny. I have been caught out by that myself. Not this year, but I think last year or one of the years we were in, maybe coming out of lockdown or just out of lockdown, or maybe the third lockdown, I swear to God, I ate all the Easter eggs that I bought and I tried to replace them and every shop I ended up buying them from this obscure shop somewhere in the middle of nowhere for really a lot of money as well. Just kind of really annoyed at myself. Like, why can't I be grown up and not eat children's Easter eggs? So I'm glad I'm not alive.
Like the end of February, beginning of March, it's like £3 for an egg in Tesco's. I'm like, I'm going to be so on there, so I'll buy four. And then 3 days later, I'm like, oh, oopsie. Right, I'm going to get some more. I mean, I'm not single in this experience. James helped a lot.
Yeah, my husband, he likes to help me as well. So yeah, it's, I wonder how many homes have this same challenge. So at least we're not alone on that.
No.
So if we go back then and look at your relationship and your life with drinking, tell me what that looked like.
So I had a really tough childhood, and when I was about 12, so my parents split up when I was very young. My dad was around, not so much when we were younger. He tried, but then he had a second family, and he lived in London, so that was really tricky. The first time I ever got drunk was about, I think I was trying to work out, I was like 12 or 13 at a family wedding, my dad's family wedding. So that was fun. First hangover, what a killer. I mean, if that's not a, don't do it, I don't know what is, but obviously we ignore. Yeah. When I was about 13, my mum met this horrible man. He was really abusive, and he lived in Brighton, and she spent an awful lot of time there with him, leaving me and my brother, who is 2 years younger than me, on our own a lot. I'd always struggled with the popular kids at school. I'd been bullied for a long time, and suddenly I was in with the popular kids, and started drinking. My house became a bit of a doss house, really, with no parents there. That was the place everyone went. They all knew my mum's car, so if that was there, they walked on by. So it was there, really, meeting up at the park with all my mates, the typical. I mean, I don't know how we got away. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do it now, going into the spa and convincing the woman at sort of 13, 14 that you're old enough to buy a bottle of vodka, and yeah, mixing that with a bottle of Coke. And that was how it was. And I mean, obviously at the time you don't really appreciate how not having boundaries as a teenager affects you. At the time it's amazing, it's like, yeah, you know. Obviously that then, when I was sort of 14, led to smoking weed, that natural awful progression. Then that led on to lots of other recreational drugs, because there was no one to come home to hold me accountable and go, what are you doing, you know, or that's bad. Or I just went along with the crowd and wanted to be popular and wanted to be liked. Yeah. And wanted to fit in somewhere. So that was kind of my growing up. My dad was in and out. My relationship with him was lovely. We did have a great relationship as I was older. But our relationship, this is all stuff I've really had to unpick on my sober sort of journey so far. It's my relationship with my dad, even though it's wonderful, a lot of the time is based around getting drunk together. So when I was 15, I sort of confronted my mum about her boyfriend and the abuse, and she threw me out. And by that point, he'd lost his house. They'd moved in with us, expected the children to go back to being children, when we'd been living on our own. And it got to a point where I just had had enough and said to her that it was Boxing Day, and I said, this is what's been happening. Lots of threats of, you know, just awful things that he was going to do to me. But she didn't believe me. She threw me out. And that led to a closer relationship with my dad, because obviously he was unaware. But that, you know, we got drunk a lot. His second marriage broke down. He met a wonderful lady called Jill. We'd go up there for weekends, and it would be get there at midday, and my dad would open a 2-litre bottle of Suave Me and him would just, you know, sorry, dogs, sit and annihilate it.
Yeah.
But I loved it. It was the way I felt close to a parent. So that sort of went on. You just think it's normal at that age, you know, and I used to just love going out and getting absolutely rat-assed because it was such a good escape. I was living with my then boyfriend, whose parents were foster parents, and they were amazing. And then that relationship ended when I was 21. We just bought our first bungalow together, and then after a month, it was all over. I was like, "Ooh!" And then I met my first husband when I was 21. I was at the time working in a pub as a manager. And obviously, wow, like a kid in a sweet shop. Well, like an alcoholic in a pub, you know, when you've got free access. And in those days, it was, "Oh, can I buy you a drink?" "Yeah, of course." And you pour yourself a drink and you met my first husband. He was a drinker then. We were both really young. He was a couple of years older than me. Lots of clubbing, you know, lots of just fun times out and about. And then after, it was 6 months, I found out I was pregnant. Actually realised I was pregnant in a nightclub after saying to my friend, "Oh, I was going to wear my blue shift dress, but it didn't fit." And she's like, "Oh, you're not pregnant, are you?" And it's like this cold rush came over me. And I was like, "Oh, shit." Can't remember when my last period was, because just living this lifestyle, not caring. And danced up to my first, my boyfriend then. So he's like, "Can I get you anything?" I was like, "I think I need a pregnancy test. I think I'm pregnant." And he was like, "Oh, God, what can I do?" I went, "Go and get me a shot." I mean, how awful. You know, it's like, so obviously then, hello, baby. Had an early scan because I was completely oblivious. I was like, "I don't know. I don't know how far pregnant I am." And I was 10 weeks. So it was like, "Oh, okay." But one of the best mistakes I've ever made in my life. Had my absolutely gorgeous daughter, Lauren. And we lived together. My drinking when I had Lauren calmed down. I was only 23, just 23. And with the history of parenting I had, I was determined to be like super duper mum. Met my two oldest best friends while at antenatal classes, and then we got really close. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was my friend's son's christening, and we were all there. We went back to their house afterwards for the little party, and the children were about 7 or 8 months then, maybe a little bit older, and all the rellies went, and my friend was like, "Oh, should we get a curry?" And we were like, yeah, that would be great. It was like something we'd never done. And then, you know, it was like, "Oh, should we get some wine?" You know, it was like this revelation that we're adults and we could, you know, buy a curry and buy wine. And therein started, this rebirth of love of wine. And it just went from there. And I, again, just got stuck into this love of not feeling and you know, I was working and had Lauren, and then, you know, the girls would meet, me and my two friends meet up, and we go, "Oh, you know, should we go out tonight?" Or let's ring each other's husbands and, you know, say, "Oh, can I take Louisa out? Can I take, you know?" So that was sort of that, quite mild, really, nothing really. And then I struggled to fall pregnant with my son, Jack. We had to go through fertility treatment. So that was another lull in the old drinking. It was a real, this is the focus. Fell pregnant with him eventually after 4 years. And yeah, he was born and I had the worst postnatal depression and felt so conflicted. You know, we tried for this baby for so long and here he was. He was such an awkward sod though. from birth, didn't want to be held, didn't want to be breastfed because that meant being close to someone. You know, I had to feed him at arm's length. I just felt wretched. It was like, this is this baby that has been so wanted who just done, it was another rejection. Mm. And I started drinking again. And this time it got out of control, really. He was really tricky as a baby, as a toddler, lots of head banging, tantrums. I absolutely couldn't cope at all. And it wasn't until he was about 10 months old, where I finally said to my ex-husband, I've had enough, and left the house, phoned him and said, I'm going to drive off a cliff. I can't do this anymore. And was finally diagnosed with postnatal depression. But at not any point did any professional question whether I was drinking. So I just carried on. Jack then went to a nursery. Literally, he got kicked out of preschool because he used to bang his head on the door to leave. And they were like, you need to come and get this child, Lou. He's scaring the other kids. So I literally drove to a nursery near where I live and said, do you have any room? And they said, we have a Tuesday and a Thursday. And I said, fine, take him. And unless he's bleeding from the ears, I do not want to speak to you. You know, I was so utterly desperate. And then I got in with a group of girls at the nursery who loved to drink, loved going out, and joined that group. It was I was always looking for this group of people that wouldn't judge my drinking, that would allow me to do it, that would be as drunk as me. And my behaviour was atrocious. You know, I got into a lot of really bad situations while I was out. I'd go out for a couple, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd be coming home, not understanding why my husband was so pissed off with me. And it never really stopped from there, this cycle of drinking and numbing it all. My marriage wasn't particularly happy. And then I thought having another baby would fix it, you know, because then I'd get sober. And then we got pregnant with our George. Again, we had to have drugs to get pregnant with him. And that was great. Again, I had this purpose. Loved being pregnant, loved the thought that I was maintaining this family unit that I never had. And then after George was born, it was okay for a bit. I sort of kept a good lid on the drinking. And I don't really know when it changed. I was already on antidepressants, so I didn't get postnatal depression with George. But the drinking crept back in. It's just always been there. This relationship with my drinking has always been there. It's always been a huge, huge part of my life. And all the time I've been drinking, there's not a minute where I've thought, I want to stop. I've always thought, I need to stop this. I can see what this is doing. But I couldn't, and I didn't do anything. I stopped for a bit. I had lots of, I've done 3 days without a drink. You know, I'm so amazing. And then it would get to the Thursday and I'd think, sod it. What's the harm in just drinking this weekend? Or that typical, well, I'll only drink for 2 days of the week. But no, the old cravings kick in on a Monday morning. Even when I've got a hangover, I'd be like, get to the evening thinking I'm not drinking, and I'd think, oh, but I've got that last bit of that bottle, or I better get another one because that's not going to be enough. My marriage was very, very toxic and dark at that point. I was talking to my now husband about it, and how, and it's really hard to talk about and explain, but for a long time after we separated and split up and everything, I blamed him entirely. But, you know, on reflection, with your sober head and doing the work you need to do, I can almost kind of see where that pattern of behaviour for him started. He was losing control of his wife, who was drinking a lot. She wouldn't stop. She was getting in some really awful situations. I have to look back and take, and I've finally been able to hold my hands up and say, actually, some of this was my responsibility. Some of this blame for the failing of our marriage lays very squarely at my feet. So yeah, that's been really hard, but quite freeing. When I first met my now husband, James, I wasn't drinking as much. I felt madly, head over heelsly, passionately in love with him. The first I set eyes on him, which is mad, but it was like my heart had come home. I saw him and I just was like, huh, there you are. Wow. You know, amazing. And our paths crossed so many times, but we didn't know. I've been friends with his sister for about 20 odd years.
Oh my God.
But didn't ever meet James. You know, she used to tell me about her brother. And when he showed her, so we met on Tinder. Woo-hoo. And when we were just chatting, he showed her a picture. And said, oh, I've met this girl online. I really like her. What do you think? And she was like, that's Lou.
Oh, my God. Like,
yeah. And her first thing, which shows my reputation at the time, was she said to him, well, she'll drink you under the table. Oopsie. And so, yeah, but I didn't want to drink because I didn't want to miss a minute of being with him. But it creeps back in. And then we got to lockdown and I wasn't working. And and my daughter, she's a beauty therapist, so she wasn't working. Her partner, Josh, he was furloughed. And we had the most amazing back garden with a hot tub and a bar. And my God, did we make the most of it? And poor James was still working and would ring every night on his way home from work and go, do we need anything on my way home, meaning food? And I'd go, we need another raspberry vodka. We need another crate of Corona, you know. And then sadly, very early on into lockdown, my dad got COVID and he was 64. He was admitted into hospital at the end of March. So literally as we went into lockdown, he'd phoned me a couple of weeks before and said, oh, I feel absolutely awful. No, a week before, and said, you know, I've got this cold, I feel shocking. There was no symptoms at that point of COVID. It wasn't, we have a cold, this is what it looks like. And then his chest got really bad and he was taken into hospital, and his wife had it at the same time. And they said, yes, you've definitely got COVID, but you're holding your own, so you both need to go home and rest. A week later, his wife had to ring for an ambulance because she was getting better, whereas he was really struggling to breathe. And they rushed him into hospital and put him straight into a coma and ventilated him. And that was by far one of the toughest times of my life. We weren't allowed to see him. We'd get one phone call a day if we were lucky. The hospital would ring my dad's wife, Jill, to give an update, and it was very brief. You know, it was where he's having more oxygen, or some days it was we've managed to reduce his oxygen. And at that point, they didn't have a clue how to deal with it. No, absolutely not their fault. It was this new virus. you know, they were doing physio, they were putting him on his front, they were throwing everything they possibly could at him. And so every day we'd get this phone call between two and six. And then I'd have to filter that through to my brother, my stepsister, my half sisters, my lovely Uncle Jerry, who's my dad's brother. And so from 2 o'clock, it would be, I need a wine. I don't know what today is going to bring. Hit 6 o'clock, and whether it was good news or bad news, it was just, no, I'm not, I don't want to deal with this. I didn't want to deal with the reality that I knew was coming, that he wasn't going to survive. And then we were told at the beginning of May that it really wasn't looking very good. And it was my daughter's birthday, the 4th of May, and I got a call in the morning to say, from my stepsister, so Jill's daughter, to say, it's really not looking very good, Lou. We don't think he's going to make it. And I prayed. I'm not a religious person, but I prayed and prayed and just said, just not today, Dad. Just make it through today, because, you know, Lauren, like all the kids do, adored him. And I just thought, I don't want this on her birthday. She's been through so much. I just don't want this. Anyway, he made it through, but on the 9th of May, we got a call to say, from my stepmom, to say, do you want to come and say goodbye? They're taking him off the ventilator tomorrow. And I just said, no, I don't, because he was this big, you know, chunky, funny Welshman who would have a whole room of people in stitches. He was just the loveliest man. He was a drummer, a guitar player. He was just the life and soul of every event and party, and even sitting around having dinner. And I just thought, I cannot, after 6 weeks of him being in intensive care, I don't want to see him like that. I want him to remember him, this big old, you know, terrible laughing Welshman. And then sadly, the next day he passed, which was shocking. And I think he was number 470 or something, which just broke my heart. Not having a relationship with my mum, and then to lose your dad, who, you know, he turned into my best friend. And to lose him like that was so hard. No goodbyes, no popping in to see him and holding his hand and stuff. So then obviously it was just freefall. It was, he drank Suave, we drank Suave together, and that was it. I was just drinking from midday to I went to bed. And when the world sort of went back to normality a little bit, I just carried on drinking in the evenings. And, yeah, and it just carried on. And James is lovely, never, ever judged me, never told me to stop, never, was just there holding my hand. And the times I told him when I was pissed, I want to stop this, I need to stop this. And he would go, I will help you, but you've got to make that decision. You know, and then in the morning it would be, oh God, you know, and James would go, if you want to stop, I'll help you. And then I'd be like, I don't want to stop. You know, give me another 2 litre bottle of Suave, please, you know. So yeah, that was the hideous reasons I drank, the hideous drinking patterns of just using alcohol for my whole life to numb and escape and relinquish responsibility and just fit in. I wanted to be liked and loved, and I was fun Lou. I was, you know, pisshead Lou. You can always rely on her. If she's coming to a party, it's gonna be a good one, you know.
I could see that. I can see that. For sure. And I can see that you still are. You're still fun, Lou. But we
live so much in that version of ourselves that we create with drinking. I just want to say I'm so sorry for the loss of your dad. When you were telling it, it really made me remember all of those points in lockdown, you know, like the numbers, how they would go up on the news, and just, you know, it was a horrible time. And it was so scary, wasn't it? It was awful.
Yeah, it was so hard, and it was so isolating because, you know, even when we went back out into public, you know, into our normal-ish lives, I didn't meet anyone that had lost anyone from COVID for a very long time. And yeah, it was, and you'd go to like a barbecue and people would be going, oh, it's all a conspiracy. There's no such thing. But it's like, you know, I'd just blow up and just go, actually, it is. And this is what happened. But, you know, that's life, isn't it? And it's challenging.
Yeah, it is. So talk to me about, how did you get to the point of stopping? You know, what was happening in the months leading up, and what happened on the day when you just said, that's it?
I mean, like you say a lot on your podcasts and stuff, it is a death of a thousand cuts. I mean, I have been at rock bottom and done some terrible, embarrassing, shocking things, but not ever thought that was my rock bottom. And this time it was weird. It was very different being in this wonderful relationship with my new husband, who is my biggest cheerleader. And then finding out my daughter was pregnant with her first child. And I've been thinking about being sober for such a long time and doing it, and day ones and day threes and day fives and 2 weeks. And then, you know, excuse my language, the fuck it devil comes into your head and you just think, oh, I've done it. My liver must be all right now. Let's crack on with this, you know. But I felt, I'd had a foot operation the end of last year. I spent a lot of time on my own because I wasn't able to drive or walk. So really thinking, still drinking. And then when obviously my daughter said she was expecting, it was that really being honest with myself, what did their childhood look like? We had a great family life when it was good, brilliant. And they Lauren came over for a takeaway with me. So my husband and her partner, he's a plumber, James is an electrician. They work together a lot. So they've gone out for this like Christmas do-ish thing at the beginning of December. And then she came over and my middle son, Jack, we were getting a takeaway and watching films. And we got round to the subject of drinking because Jack doesn't drink. And I sort of said to him, do you remember me drinking when you were younger? And they both sort of looked at each other. And I said, no, I really want to know. I want to know your experience of that. And they were like, well, you know, yeah, we remember you being drunk. And they regaled a few cringeworthy stories. And I just thought, wow, it was a real, and I didn't really say I want to give up. I just said, oh. And I said, what do you think of my drinking now? And they were like, well, it's not as bad at all. But, you know, you still like a drink. And I was like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I love it. So that was sort of that conversation. But it just got that thought in my head of, you know, I've got a grandbaby on the way. What do I want them to remember of me? What do I want them to see in me? And it's not that anymore. Mm. You know, I am a grown-up. And for the first time in my life, I'm in a really good place. I'm in a really happy marriage. My children are all amazing. My stepkids are lovely. James's family are just the best. They're so loving. His mum and dad have been together forever. His sister's incredible. They've all just tucked me into their family, even though at first I was an awkward cow because I was like, no, I don't need family. No, no. And I just thought, you know, if you can't do it now, boo, then what are you doing? And so I spoke to one of my besties, Selena, and just said, so I was always sounding people out and sort of said, look, you know, I think I want to stop drinking. And she was like, right, okay. And I said, and I'd started getting into this habit, and this was another thing I really didn't like. We'd go around to their house, I'd get pissed, and I'd start on James. And I would find the smallest thing, and that would turn into a big thing. And he never argued back. He was so sweet and kind about it all. And I'd wake up feeling like an arsehole. And I just thought, I'm doing it again. I'm going to start those patterns again. I'm going to push this amazing man to not like me. And she was like, if you want to do it, you know. And she recommended Alan Carr's Stop Drinking Now. And she drinks. And she said, but my friend stopped. And she read this book. And I said, oh, okay, yeah, I might get it. Obviously straight on Amazon. And within three chapters, I was like, wow, I am stopping. This is insane. Everything I've read is me in black and white. But I still didn't say anything. And went through Christmas drinking. And in the book, it's really good because it doesn't say, right, you need to stop today and read this book. It's like, if you carry on drinking, that's fine. Do it while you're reading it. Mm. Which takes the pressure off completely.
Yeah.
And then it got to New Year's Eve, and I sort of said to James in the day, I'm giving up alcohol. I'm going to stop drinking. And he was like, right. And he'd already seen the book and was interested in what he... And I said, well, I just don't think it's serving me anymore. I don't like the amount of time it takes up in my head. You know, the constant, when can I drink? Where do I get it from? How much is it? Have I got enough money? You know, well, I can't drive to that event because I won't be able to drink, so I just won't go. It just, that constant, as you know well, that record that just goes on and on and on in your head. So we went to New Year's Eve with all our friends, our big group of friends, and I took a bottle of Prosecco and thought, I'm going to see how this feels doing this. I mean, for me, a bottle of Prosecco is nothing. So, you know... And I felt amazing. I felt great. And
because you didn't drink it?
Because I was drinking it, but yeah, not at the volume, right, that I would normally be. I mean, I'd normally be three bottles of wine in.
Yeah.
So I was drinking it, but then drinking water and thinking, okay, I want to do this soberish. I want to see how this feels. To go cold turkey would have been too scary. And one of my friends came up and said, are you drinking? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, oh, what's that in your glass? And I said, it's water at the minute. And she was like, why aren't you drinking? It was really like...
shock.
And it was like, I don't... And I said, because if you remember, last New Year's Eve, I had to leave just after midnight because I was a sobbing, snot-bubbling mess because I drank far too much, got super emotional about a load of old shit, and James had to take me home, and I don't want to do that again. And I think that kind of sealed the deal. I was like, okay, well, this isn't 100% sober. This is as sober as I've been for a long time, and it feels amazing. And that was it. I haven't touched a drop since.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was like ending a bad relationship. And I tell everyone this. When you're done, you're done.
Mm.
Something just switches and you go, I've had enough of this now. I'm worth more than this. I deserve more than this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly how I felt. I was done.
Mm.
I was done. I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I need to grow up.
I
need to grow up and just, I need to change my life, and I'm not going to do it if I'm drinking alcohol.
No.
I knew I wouldn't. But what's really fascinating about your story is, how did you go from drinking a lot less on that night and not get stuck there? Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
I don't get stuck with, okay, I'll just... Because one of the steps that I find people struggle with the most when they're trying to change their relationship with alcohol or stop drinking is that desire to just learn how to moderate better so that they don't have to let it go. You know, it doesn't have to go away for good. They can just have it a little bit. But obviously that's very trapping because really I think with moderation, you're always close to living on a knife edge because any time, whatever that ratio is, one in five times of drinking, you're going to mess up and it's going to go. So how did you transition from, I'm not going to drink three bottles of wine, I'm just going to have the one bottle of wine, which some people listening might think, well, I, you know, that's still
a lot.
But yeah, that's still a lot. But how did you go from just drinking that to completely getting rid of it? Why didn't you get trapped in the moderation trap?
I think you have to be, and this is something I've never been, but I knew I had to be, really honest with myself. Really, really honest with myself. I know I can't moderate. I can't moderate anything in life. I am all in or I'm all out. I've tried moderating in the past and I come home like, yay, I'm only slightly pissed, you know, and I've tried it. And like you say, it's like living in turmoil because even when you're out, you're not enjoying your time out because you're thinking, oh, I need to stop now. Oh, but I don't want to stop. Oh, but I've got to. Oh, but look, they're getting drunk so they won't notice. Oh, and I just thought, do you know what? I've got to just do cold turkey. I've just got to, you know, and I think doing the learning, some of the work before I stopped, really understanding the effects of alcohol on your mind and your body, even though I'd only read three or four chapters, it resonated so hard with me that I just thought, I can try moderating again, but who am I kidding?
Yeah.
Who am I kidding? I can't do it. I know I won't be able to do it because I have a real problem with drink, the same as I have a problem with crocheting, that once I start I can't stop. You know, once I start eating chocolate I can't stop. When I learn a new hobby I can't stop. I have to have all the stuff, all the equipment, and it lasts 6 weeks and then it's all over and I'm on to the next thing. And I just thought, right, Lou, you're either in or out. And so, and I think I was really kind to myself. I didn't tell anybody. I kept it really quiet because I didn't trust myself. I didn't think I could do it, but I knew I had to do it. I knew my physical health was suffering. My tummy was constantly upset. My skin was a mess. I was overweight, aches and pains, headaches, palpitations. My mental health has always been in bits, but then I've always drunk.
Yeah.
So, and I think once you start, and every hour that goes by in the beginning, you know, feels like a huge thing. It's like, I did it, I did it, I did it. First weekend, I remember the first weekend on the Friday, saying to James, oh God, I really fancy a glass of wine, almost sounding him out. Because if he'd have said, we'll have one then, I would have absolutely stopped at 5 days. But he was so good with me. And he said, well, have one if you like, but you're doing so well. How are you going to feel tomorrow? You're going to feel really rubbish about yourself. You're going to be hungover because you won't have a glass of wine. And it was that. And I thought, and it also, it was that a little bit of, oh, he doesn't like me drinking. But he never said it. So it wasn't a challenge. It wasn't a, ah, you must stop. It was a gentle, and I thought, no, I'm not going to drink. And I'll see what tomorrow. I said, no, I'm not drinking tonight then. We'll see what tomorrow brings.
Yeah.
And I got through that first weekend. It was like, holy shit. Yeah. I did it.
Yeah.
And I'm bloody lucky, you know. But I have worked really, really hard. You know, I think a lot of family and friends probably think it's just a case of me going, I'm not drinking again, and just not picking up a drink. it's so much deeper than that. It's reading all the books, listening to all the podcasts, educating yourself about it all. And then for me, one of the hardest but the best things is getting to know Sober Lou. I've never known her. Mm. And forgiving Pissed Up Lou, Party Lou, for a lot. And learning all about myself has been wonderful. It's been really freeing and just powerful. Understanding and really understanding. And you do it by, like, when I'm at work, I've constantly got either a sober book going on in my head or a podcast, like your podcast, I just love. And it gives you little eureka moments.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to someone else's story and you go, oh, that makes perfect sense.
Yes.
That's why I did that. That's why I drank like that. That's what I was running away from.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine that a person with a wonderful upbringing, you know, the most stable life, the most wonderful surroundings and people, you know, I just can't imagine that. I don't know. I just feel like all the stories I've heard, all the people I've heard from, all the books I've read, everyone that drinks the way I drank, they're escaping a trauma, or lots of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not given the tools when we're young or when we're adults. I mean, I think it's a lot better now to be able to process those traumas in a really healthy way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been spending a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about my upbringing and coming to terms with that and, you know, and coming to terms with the breakdown of my marriage, the death of my dad, lots of stuff.
Mm.
And sitting in your feelings.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to do, I think.
Oh, really hard.
So hard to do. And yeah, and it just, it feels very alien to do that, I think, at first.
Yeah, because who wants to feel the shitstorm?
Yeah.
You know, who wants to feel the shame? Who wants to feel the loss? Mm. But there's something so powerful in doing that and letting that feeling come and think, God, that was so awful. I did that to that person. And then going, and I acknowledge that feeling of shame. I can't do anything about it, but I will be absolutely damned if I ever do anything like that again.
Mm.
You know, and making and deciding to be better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a choice, isn't it? It becomes a choice. You choose to live differently and to not keep repeating the patterns that at one time did serve you well, because it was how you got through things and how you coped, or whether that was trauma. Like you say, I think a lot of people's drinking is born, the root of that is trauma, but it can also be other things like social anxiety, or, you know, personality, not feeling like you're not fitting in, and shyness. And some people can not drink at all when they're young and start drinking in their 30s and can go rapidly downhill but I think for a lot of us it just becomes the coping mechanism. And you're right, we don't get taught how to feel our feelings. This isn't about blaming our parents, because our parents weren't taught how to feel our feelings, you know. And I think only really now, this sort of generation, or these conversations and all the podcasts on mental health, the focus, and, you know, just so, there's so much more dialogue around this stuff now. So, yeah, it sounds like you've been on such a journey, you know, and that, you know, I always think that's 100 days. Imagine another 100 days or and another few hundred days. Yes. How much more is on that path for you? It's so exciting. Mm.
And I feel really grateful, because I know some people get to 100 days and the future just looks enormous, like I'm never going to drink again. And I completely get that. That's why I've had so many day ones and threes and fives. but this time just feels so different. And if I can feel this powerful and empowered at 100 days, I can't wait to see where the next 100 takes me. Yes. And how much more I'm going to learn about myself and the, you know, your evidence cup just filling up. I mean, I went to a gig on Friday night and I'd, you know, made it very clear. I'm happy to give people lifts, but you need to know that I, you know, if I need to leave, I will just go. It's not because I'm not having a good time. It's because it's all overwhelming. I had the best bloody time. And my friend Tam, she came up to me watching this tribute guy. He was amazing. And after about an hour and a half, she just whispered in my ear, she went, "Oh, you're having such a shit time. I think you better go home." And I was like, "I'm having a wonderful day," you know. And all those things that you do, and then waking up on Saturday and a bit achy from all the dancing, but like clear and ping, I'm up. And watching my poor husband be like, "Oh, I'm not so with it and awake."
Yeah.
And going, ha-ha.
Yeah. It transforms the weekend, doesn't it? Not drinking. Oh, yeah. It's so transformative for weekends. You just, that joy when we wake up and you feel well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still feel it now, you know. I still feel it years in. I just think, oh, God, it's so nice. The kids are all up. Three kids, young kids. Mine aren't, you know, mine are still all under 11. But, you know, they've got that energy for a lot of things at 7 a.m. on a Saturday.
Yeah.
But I can, you know, I can cope with it. You know, it doesn't,
yeah.
I don't get frustrated, but, or, you know, sometimes feel burnt out by midday. But you can just, you've got the energy. And I just, when I look back at when I was drinking and I was always waking up at 70% minimum, and you just think, how do you get through the day?
I just don't know how I did it. Well, I know how I did it. I was a miserable cow most of the time with no patience. I mean, like with George not being at school now, that was a decision I've made, you know, within this 100 days that school wasn't working for him, never has worked for him. He won't do it, he can't do it. And I was saying to James, I'm so glad I made this decision now I'm sober, because otherwise, if I'd still been drinking, every night would have been party night, because I have nothing, you know. I can get up for work, I work for myself, so I can get up for work, just send them all a message, go, "I'm running a bit late today," and push my whole day back. So it all happened at the right time, and now I can focus on what I need to do for him to help him get educated and stuff. But man, that would have been a train wreck. I'd have done it when I was still drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it doesn't bear thinking about, really. You mentally just can't cope, I don't think, when you're drinking with those sorts of challenges. And that, unfortunately, that keeps feeding the cycle then, though, doesn't it? Because those feelings of not being able to cope push you further in to 1 o'clock at whenever, 6 o'clock.
Definitely. And you think you're coping. You just think that's how you are. And you think you have an inability to manage and cope. You know, for years I thought, I just don't manage life very well. I just don't cope with stress and life very well. It's my mental health. And now I look back and I think, Christ, no, it was the amount of alcohol I was inhaling nightly that completely reduced my ability to do almost anything.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I don't, I mean, I talked about it on our meeting the other day about how I now feel like I want to shout from the rooftops and go to everyone, "It's a lie. It's a big fucking lie. Alcohol does not make you feel better. It makes you feel like shit. And you will continue to feel like shit until you get up. And trust me, after the first 30 days, you will wonder what the hell you've done with your life." Yeah. But you can't, you know, and I know someone who gave up drinking and became this evangelical, you know, non-drinker. And as a drinker, you just think, oh, shut up. you're drinking poison. That's poison you're putting in your body. Just think, yeah, watch me, bird. Look, where? But so having to hold that in a bit is quite hard.
Yeah.
You're like, please don't drink that.
I know. It's so funny, isn't it? I also felt like that when I went through my angry phase in sobriety, but I felt like, why is this pushed on us so much?
Yeah.
I was like, look to my husband, look, Tom, as soon as we walk into the supermarket, it's just a wall of alcohol. And look at that, look at that. And you just, I feel like you just wake up and you notice this whole conspiracy going on around you just to get drinking more. Whatever we do, make sure she's got a drink in her hand because that's where we need her. And it's like the Truman Show or something. And it's like, wow, you really start to see that. But I think that can cause frustration as well because you feel, I felt very hoodwinked. You know, I just felt like I had no chance really
in
life. That I was always going to drink. In a weird way, it's like, well done us, because we've bloody done it. And not without difficulties as well, you know. It is to break free from all that conditioning. And the fact that when you do stop drinking, people think you have the problem because you can't stop drinking. It's like, well, no, hang on a minute. Trying to better my life, you know, just give me a break. Stop making me feel shit for trying to improve my life. But... and I can say that now with a lot of confidence now that I'm 5 years in. But in the beginning, I struggled with that. You know, I cared about what people thought. I cared about other people's opinions. I felt embarrassed that I was the one that couldn't drink properly.
Yeah.
You know, that I always went too mad. You know, God, I'm so shit. You know, but I realize now that's not.
It's just madness.
Who can drink properly? Really?
And who should drink properly?
Yeah, who has the perfect relationship with alcohol? It's easy to look at people's Instagram grids or Facebook pages or the way that people seem to act when they're at, and, you know, you think that people have it all under control. Nobody really knows what anyone else is doing with alcohol.
Right.
And all I know is there are way more people than you think that have problems with alcohol.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's like, right? So...
I mean, you feel rebellious. That's how I feel now. I'm like, I am a rebel.
Yeah,
I remember I listened to the Huberman Lab and his 2-hour episode on the effects of alcohol and stuff. And I remember telling my husband about it and going, I want to start a fucking riot. I want to start like some movement. You know, I want to paint my house and just say to people, you're all being fooled, you know.
Yeah.
It's and what really scares me now is how we sort of our kids get older and it's almost like a rite of passage to have that drink. Why do we do that? That's madness. I mean, knowing what we know now, obviously we'd never do it, but why is it seen as such a well done, you know, you're 18 or most of the time it's a lot younger than that, you know, have a drink, let's go to the bar and buy your first pint. And it knowing what we know now, it's baffling, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's baffling.
It is baffling. Yeah,
and you do get angry.
Yeah,
I mean, I do a lot of eye rolling, a lot now. Like watching the telly, and there's, you know, gorgeous, super slim supermodel on a beach with a, you know, pina colada, trying to sell you a holiday, and I just want to scream at the telly, fuck off!
Yeah,
get out of my front room.
Exactly. I understand that. I feel the same. And I think that when I go to all-inclusives, which I've only started doing with kids, I say that like I go all the time. I've literally done it once. I've got another one planned in May, so I would have done it twice. But in the morning when you go for breakfast, there is, you know, 3 or 4 bottles of Prosecco open at 9.
Yes.
And I can't stop looking at the people. And it sounds really judgy, and I don't mean it in a judgmental way, because I'm just intrigued. I think, because I think I would have been 100% been the person that
absolutely
would have done that. So yeah, no judgment on that front, but it's looking at it through a different lens now, just like, what is that culture that has Along with Nutella pancakes and fresh fruit and yogurt, there is, you know, three chilled bottles of Prosecco in a huge silver bucket thing with all the glasses lined up. And it's like, you know, and it's quite busy, you know, there's a lot of people drinking. And I just think, gosh, you know, it's because of things like that, that we are in this situation, because all of that behavior is not only acceptable, but it's very encouraged. And I think that's the point I was trying to make, is that, you know, since from when you're a child and you see your parents having fun drinking in parties, and, you know, when you're 18, you're allowed to go to the pub. Although, like, you know, I was getting bought bottles of alcohol on my 16th birthday by my mum and by other adults, you know, and you think, God, that 16, full big bottles of spirits, you know, like Taboo and Malibu.
Oh my God.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Southern Comfort.
Southern Comfort. Yeah. Southern Comfort and lemonade. But, you know, and it's just, yeah, it's kind of, it is frustrating, I think. I think you do move through that, though, but it still sometimes catches me off guard now. I'll still sometimes watch a TV show and I'll be quite shocked when they're knocking back drinks or smoking. There's another one.
Yeah.
And I think, God, that's, why does that need to be there? But anyway, you know, yeah, it's, I don't think, whilst I think that the tide is turning, which is really positive, I still think there's a long way to go probably before that.
Absolutely.
So just thinking about your, you know, and your tips are so valid here as well, because you're 100 days in and you've done amazingly well. You're feeling brilliant. What is the advice that you would give people? You know, what are your kind of top three tips for getting sober?
Number one, and I think the most important one, educate yourself. You have to throw yourself into it like you would a bottle of Prosecco when you're drinking. You know, you have to go, I want to know everything there is about this. So read everything you can read, listen to everything you can listen to. You know, you're going to find some really uncomfortable truths, like we were just saying, about how we've all been lied to and stuff and how that feels. But you've got to do it. I mean, I started reading Alan Carr's Stop Drinking Now before I stopped drinking. And I think without the knowledge that he was giving me, it's white knuckling it. You can't white knuckle this. You just can't. You can't put down that glass and hope that you're not going to drink again. You have to, the same as anything you want to be really good at, you have to learn about it and you have to really throw yourself into it. Number two, be kind to yourself. Be kind to yourself. Forgive yourself. Love yourself. Learn to love yourself. I'm learning to really love myself again for who I am now, and not dwelling on the past. You've just got to be kind. You've got to hunker down and eat the chocolate. You know, you've got to, whatever it takes for you to feel 100% comfortable, you've got to do. Learn about your boundaries that keep you safe, you know, like I did and everyone, you know, does, is, yes, I'll drive you to this event, but I may not take you home. Set the expectations really early so that you're not dragged into that. And just, if you want to say no, say bloody no. We're so programmed, aren't we? Oh, Lou, do you want to come to the pub? And you're like, no, I don't. I don't want to come to the pub with you and sit in a pub garden and hear your stories for the 30th time. Not because I don't love you, but because I'd rather have a coffee and a proper chat, you know. And if your instinct is going no, listen to it. Listen to her. She's got your best interests at her heart.
Yeah.
And number three, surround yourself with supporters. And the people that you feel able to open up to, that you get a really good response from. So I was very picky about who I told. And I was quite ready to drop contact with those people for a period of time until I felt strong enough. I've been really lucky to have a steadfast group of people around me who champion me every day, and be that family or friends. The Thrive community is incredible. You know, when you go on there, whether you're having a wobble like I did over Easter, you know, that was a really tough weekend for me because it was normally absolutely booze fueled, or whether you go on to say, I didn't do it. I was offered a glass of wine and I didn't pick it up and drink it. You know, the response you get from all the amazing women on there, it's another, you know, it's just like, I want to make them proud because they're all so incredible. Yeah. And they have your back 100%. There's no judgment. There's no snarky comments. It's not like a crap Facebook group where it all starts off lovely and then turns to shit and everyone gets a little bit catty. It's not like that at all. It's just a beautiful, beautiful community of women that are all trying their very best to be their best version. So, yeah, just throw yourself in it. Surround yourself with supportive, amazing people that act as your crash mat. You know, when you're feeling like shit, you can just go, I'm done. Wait, wait, guys, come round and go, go on then, Luke. Off to bed we go. Let's talk about it. Yeah, and just be kind to your lovely, lovely newborn sober self like you would a little baby, because you're learning about it all from afresh.
I love that. I love all of that. I love crash mat as well. I'm going to have to steal that one. That's brilliant. Yeah, be kind to yourself. Oh my God, have we just all not been just so unkind to ourselves for so long?
Yeah.
So, and the drinking really exacerbates that, I think. Drink too much, put yourself down. It's your fault. It's not your fault, you know. I really feel like that with myself as well now. I don't feel any real shame. I've done shameful things, don't get me wrong, but I just think you've changed the narrative, you know. You've broken the cycle.
Yeah.
You just don't have to keep in that cycle anymore. It's gone. And when you look back over the things that were not ideal, just understand that you weren't doing it to be bad or horrible or you just lost. Just quite lost, really.
You're just doing whatever it takes to get through. And I think with alcohol you make some really shitty mistakes, and when you make enough of those you begin to believe you're a shitty person. But you're not. Really not. And it's you just need to just be kind to yourself and love every step of learning your sober self, because she's bloody amazing.
Yeah.
And she's in there going, help me get out, free the beast.
At long last.
Yeah, here I am, baby. Feed me chocolate and call me Sophie.
Yeah, I love it. Where can we find you?
So I have just changed my Instagram over to a sober journey. So that's Lou's Sober Journey, all one word. And I will be posting lots of stuff on there about my journey, amazing quotes I've seen, information, funny stuff, because you need a bloody sense of humour to to get through this life. And anyone wants to message me, reach out to me, always do. I'm not an expert yet. Nowhere near, and it takes you a lifetime to become an expert in anything, but I am more than happy to be near a crash map. So yeah, just do it.
Love it. So that's Lou's, Lous.
Yes.
Two S's, yeah? So Lou's and then Sober Journey, all one word. Brilliant. Yeah. Oh, Lou, I'm delighted that we managed to get this. We timed it so well in the end. 100 days over. You've come on the podcast.
Best day ever.
Yeah, what a way to celebrate. And and just share your truth and, you know, share your life. And thank you for doing that. And thank you for being a big inspiration as well, because this is inspirational, what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Well, couldn't do it without you, Bird, and all your amazing, all your amazing tools. It's amazing.
Oh, I'm delighted. I'm delighted that we got you on the show, and yeah, thank you again.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.